Welcome back to the Fundamentals of Application Lifecycle Management. I'm Stephen Borg.
And I'm James Tupper.
And we're now going to talk about one of my favorite topics, DevOps and continuous delivery, a core piece of software development life cycles and application lifecycle management. Let's get started. Here's where we are. We're module number 2 of 4, and we're going to talk about getting feedback faster. We saw some fast feedback, but now how do we build that pipeline? So DevOps and continuous delivery is next. Mm-hmm. And here's our module. We're going to be doing an introduction to DevOps to start. What is DevOps? And we're going to define it very clearly. We'll move on to continuous delivery. We'll talk through some continuous delivery pieces. And then we'll talk about some patterns and anti-patterns. These are things you might see reflections of the way you do development in some of these patterns. If so, you need continuous delivery. And then we'll talk about getting started with DevOps. Mm-hmm. Just some of the core principles of this. This is more slides, less demo. James will jump in to cover some of this, and mm-hmm. I'll be covering a lot of it as well. Let's start with an introduction to DevOps. I love this quote. I think it's important to start with it. Firms today experience a much higher velocity of business change. Market opportunities appear or dissolve in months or weeks instead of years. I remember being on software development teams where we literally came up with an idea and had a year and a half to put our first production piece to customers. A year and a half, and I think of that today. I'm like, wow, there's probably 50 startups that are gonna come in and eat your lunch prior to you getting there in a year and a half. There's just no way we can do that today. The market opportunity will be gone. If you see it, you need to get to it quickly, hammer it, find it, exploit it, and then start getting customers and build from it. Mm-hmm. And this is true whether or not you're a web startup in Silicon Valley or something, you could be in the middle of the biggest organization delivering only internal products, but the marketplace outside of your org is changing so fast that what you think is the important application you build might not be as important in a year. So you need to move very, very rapidly. So what is DevOps? Now, the ongoing joke is that if you ask 10 DevOps experts a definition of DevOps, you'll get 11 answers. So there's a lot of confusion around DevOps. Yeah.
Totally.
Is it things like collaboration? Do we have collaborative environments? Is that it? Is that what DevOps means? We just collaborate between Dev and Ops? Or does it mean something like we treat our infrastructure as code? We often hear that mm-hmm. in the DevOps space. Does it mean we automate everything? Is it feature switches? So we can go to production with code that hasn't been tested yet and isn't ready to be seen. We've deployed it, but not released it because we haven't switched off. Or is it small deployments or small releases? Is that what DevOps means? And some people just flat out say, well, DevOps is Kanban for operations. I think that's totally wrong. But you hear all these different things. And the reality is, there's probably no good definition right now for DevOps. DevOps is a mindset. It's a way of thinking. It includes two very important roots, however, development and operations, and getting Dev and Ops to work together. If you think back on the Agile 10 years ago, I remember going to conferences, or 6 or 7 years ago, going to conferences and people standing up and showing unit testing, and now that we have developer testing, we no longer need testers. That was really part of the zeitgeist for a while. And what happened was we realized, no, developers and testers need to work really closely together. They need to sit together. There's value in both, but they sit together and work together. And this is the next extension of that. We're taking those delivery teams, the dev and test, and moving it in to integrate with the operations teams like we did dev and testers. And so that's kind of what's happening in that space. Well, you can think of it really as an emerging trend that promises to increase the flow of value to customers. Mm-hmm. Kind of a businessy, weirdy one, but
I kind of like that idea of value flowing through your pipeline, right? A lot of the times we think of how much scope can we give to these set of resources and when can they be done by it versus how do we get something from one end of the system to the other end of the system in as fast as possible way, right? So getting it all the way through every single stage and flowing from one to the next gate, whether it's from BAs to developers to testers to ops, you want to focus on streamlining that process versus streamlining every single process in between, right?
Excellent. And I love that. That's a perfect definition. It's the holistic view, just like ALM, but getting things through that pipeline as quickly as possible, specifically with that development and operations piece as being critical. Mm-hmm. DevOps is calming, or DevOps calms. It's an acronym you can use. To remember it, it's all about culture, hearts and minds.
Yeah.
It is about automation, that continuous delivery and infrastructure as code. Mm. It's about lean thinking, focusing on value, just like you nailed it. We want to focus on value. And how do we do that? Small batches sometimes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It is about metrics. We want to start measuring everything, including how are customers using those requirements that we've built and delivered, and now they have the potential value. Are our customers actually getting value out of what we delivered? And if so, that's fantastic. If not, oops, what do we need to change? Then the last is sharing. And this is kind of a fuzzy, soft piece, right? But it's that open, collaborative sharing between the development team and the operations team. It's sitting down and saying to the operations team, hey, let's go sit down for lunch somewhere and let's talk about potentially what we're doing in development that is giving you fits in operations, mm-hmm. or vice versa. We want to know those things.
Yeah, every time I talk to you, I'm more of a dev sort of person. So every time I talk to the operations side that's dealt with a lot of configuration management and that sort of thing, I always learn something new because I'm not usually focused on that sort of area, right? I'm usually more focused in code and how to build something versus, all right, great, it's built. You know, what do you have to do on the other side of it, right?
Right.
And I think it's super valuable to be able to talk to people that do very radically different things so that you can learn and understand and maybe make it easier for them as you're focusing on that flow through the system.
Well, and I think you've nailed it, James, because there is a conflict between the two people in a little ways,
yeah.
and you really need to break down that wall. But the conflict isn't weird. It doesn't arise out of just animosity and bad people on either side. Mm-hmm. Developers get paid to build things. They get paid for change. IT operations on the other side gets paid for stability. Change often interferes with stability. So they're motivated by two very different pieces.
Almost at odds.
Almost at odds, yeah.
And absolutely.
when we get to continuous delivery, we're going to find out how that going at odds maybe can end up in friendship and, you know, rainbows and unicorns. But that, it's a possibility because we can actually lower risk by deploying very, very often, as long as our changes are small.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll talk about some of those techniques where it looks like they're completely at odds, and in most organizations, they are motivated by very different things.
Mm-hmm.
We'll see how actually it's a false dichotomy, and we can get an answer to both of those through continuous delivery. So those are the main things. Let's take a look at some of the DevOps benefits. One of the biggest research studies was done by Puppet Labs, and it's the 2014 State of DevOps report. And here's some quotes directly from it. I think one of the things that's very important is companies that are doing DevOps are ship code 30 times faster than self-reported companies that do not do DevOps and complete those deployments on average 8,000 times faster than their peers. I mean, that's just, we're talking just crazy numbers, right? But the other thing, they have 50% fewer failures and restore service when they have breaking changes 12 times faster.
That's crazy.
It's absolutely crazy, right? Again, this is a self-reported study, but it's across a wide swath of of industries and a wide swath of development teams. If you look at some of the other benefits, the perceived benefits, you'll things like improved quality of the deployments, more frequent releases, improved visibility into the process, cultural change. One of the big things is cultural change that's increased that collaboration between different parts of the organization. A lot of these things, in fact, helps with more agile development. Here's another slide covering another wide stretch of DevOps benefits. This from a white paper by CA Technologies called DevOps, the worst kept secret to winning in the application economy. because a lot of people are doing it. And here are the benefits, again, a self-reported survey, the benefits that people have already seen and the benefits they expect to see. Mm-hmm. Increased frequency of deployments, increased collaboration, you see many of the same things, increased quality. I love this one, an increase in revenue. That's where it hits the bottom line mm-hmm. for a lot of firms.
Yeah.
A reduction in spend on developing, testing, or operations. Actually lowering the costs.
I think another really big one here is the reduced time to market, right? Because a lot of the times you want to reduce risk and make sure that we are right on time, so you plan big. Yeah. Whereas if you do small chunks into that larger, the larger release, it actually gets done faster, usually.
Yes, mm-hmm. I absolutely agree. Mm-hmm. It's an incredible thing, that time to market. Shorter the time to market, the more time you have to explore the market and maybe find out where you need to go. That's a fantastic point. DevOps is really just an extension of application lifecycle management. Some people, I've heard them call it DevOps as ALM 2.0. I think that's a little pushing it. ALM covers that whole lifecycle. Theoretically, so does DevOps, but DevOps tends to focus on a smaller subset. It doesn't focus as much in the gathering of the requirements, other than they should be small and quickly deliverable.
Yeah.
More in the development and operations side of the house. Mm-hmm. But it goes through kind of that same circle of love, which you've seen earlier, but plan, development, doing some testing, releasing, monitoring and learning, the things that happen between that development and the operations teams. Mm-hmm. The problem is there are a lot of things that get in the way or things that can drive DevOps. And these are things that drive it. Not necessarily problems you will run into implementing DevOps, but things that drive your DevOps implementation. The number one that I've seen is lower left. This is where you have iterative methodologies or agile methodologies that are speeding up the development lifecycle. Dave West, when he was with Forrester, had a great article. It was called Water Scrum Fall. It was basically what's happening in the real world. We gather a bunch of requirements, have this big stack of requirements, we hand it to the dev team, which slips it on its side and delivers incrementally. They do Scrum or something very quick, and then it just piles up in operations, and then we do one deployment 6 months later. Water Scrum Fall as the reality of software delivery. What has happened, however, as dev teams have gotten agile and have gotten very, very good at slicing things up into small pieces and delivering it to test environments, there's been a lot of demand from customers to say, if you're done coding it and if you've tested it, why can't you just give it to me? Well, we're waiting for the next release. Well, when is that going to happen and can we accelerate it? Operations is under a lot of pressure from development, who's pushing things very quickly in smaller and smaller increments. And that's one of the big drivers. So ironically, one of the things that is driving this conflict and this change is something that we consider a good, which is this agility of mm-hmm. dev teams. Other things, operations can't keep up with releases. We kind of talked about that. Troubleshooting performance. And availability is often difficult. We don't have good monitoring in place.
Yeah.
And we're not prioritizing investments based on real-world usage.
I think that's a big one, too, is a lot of the times we push these features or these enhancements or these bug fixes that we deem as high business value, when in reality, we don't actually know if it actually is, right? We create a new... We let's say we develop three new features. If we're not gathering metrics off those three new features, we have no idea which one's being used, which one's being used more than the other ones, or if they're useful at all, or if anyone can even see them, right? So it's really important to, you know, again, back to the metrics and the fast feedback, but you need to make decisions based off of the metrics and based off of the feedback that you get.
Oh, that brings up, it just reminded me of a quote or of a thought, and I cannot remember the person's name, but I will try to look it up and maybe get it in the Q&A panel. But it was a director at Bing, and who was working through a lot of laying out the new functions they were delivering. And he said that of the things, that, I mean, these are not just throwing ideas to the wind, but these are well thought out, researched ideas that they were going to implement. And he said, out of those, only 1/3 had value. The other 2/3 had either no value or had negative value. So here we are looking at things that have been reviewed by your business analysts, you've gone out to customers and gotten feedback from customers, and they say, yeah, that would be awesome. And they built those, but in reality, only 1/3 of those ideas provided value. Yikes, you gotta have that feedback,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, it's important. It's massively, massively important to get feedback.
So how can DevOps help your business? There's a few different areas. I'm going to cover 5. We've seen the benefits, but here are 5 just kind of laid out in a nice graphical format, right? Helps you accelerate your delivery, get things out to production faster. Mm-hmm. It helps you optimize your resources. You're not spending a bunch of time doing boring, repetitive deployments.
Yeah.
You're automating those. Mm-hmm. There's more resilience. If you have a problem, you can redeploy to another area of the environment, another area even of the geographic location,
yeah,
quickly. You just point your builds to another Azure subscription and boom.
It's all automated.
And it's all automated, right? Out you go.
Yep.
Faster detection and remediation. Mm-hmm. Part of this DevOps culture is understanding what's happening.
Yeah, you're constantly getting metrics and feedback, so it's pretty obvious that you'll get faster.
Yeah, faster response time.
Yeah.
Exactly. I mean, I really don't care if you have a bug in your application as long as you fix it before I ever notice it, right? Mm-hmm. And one of the things that if you have good metrics behind the scenes, you may find out that you just have a bug in your application, but you might be able to remediate it, measured in minutes or hours as opposed to days. Most of your customers will probably never see it. So it's a good thing to have. And the last is experimentation. It allows you to create some ideas, some experiments, and quickly get them out there and try them out.
Yeah.
And I'll talk more about experimentation later, but I think that's a powerful, powerful reason for it.
Now, can we go back real quick?
Yeah, absolutely.
And there's one distinction I wanna make with these five different areas that can help your business. Mainly the fact that just because you do DevOps or you're going to do DevOps or you start doing DevOps doesn't mean that you'll get these benefits right out the gate, right? These are benefits that are potential, and they're potentially things that kind of fall out when you start doing automated builds and deployments and you switch your perspective to a continuous delivery perspective, right? These things, it's easier to support these things and these things are easier to attain. But that doesn't mean that you'll get them right out the gate, right? You still have to work to get them and be able to do things like experimentation. And you have to build that in. That doesn't mean that I'm doing DevOps now, so I get these benefits, right? There's no silver bullet, right?
That is yeah. Very true. That's a good point. And it kind of brings us a little bit, grounds us back in reality, because
yeah,
there are a lot of complexities. And in this demonstration, James is going to show off a little bit of just our continuous integration build. But it's a pretty elaborate pipeline that
yeah,
this goes through to get everything out. I mean, it took us, to get the first iteration out, it took a full, I think, 2 or 3 days to get the first full continuous delivery pipeline mm-hmm. out there. And that was for an app that was very small.
Yeah.
Now it's grown substantially
yes,
since then. If we had to write it from now, it would be a week or you know.
Right, and it goes back to the idea of fail fast. There's so many things that we've done so far that we've done incorrectly. And we've had to throw it away and redo it. But they're learnings, right? Now we understand it so much better, and we have a better process and a better way to do it now.
Yes, absolutely. I think that's absolutely the case. We've learned as we've gone, and we've had this windy path of architectures and mistakes, and it's because there is no DevOps cookie cutter that you can grab and boom, here's your DevOps. Mm-hmm. It just doesn't work like that. Even something as technical as continuous delivery has to take into account your culture, the way you do things, what sign-offs you have. There's just a lot of things that go into making that determination. Mm-hmm. So, since we just briefly introduced continuous delivery, let's talk it. It's fast automated feedback. This is from Jez Humble. I've kind of adapted it a little bit. But on the production readiness of your application every time there's a change. And that change is to code, infrastructure, or configuration. And I think it's very important that we talk about all three of those things. Because it's not just you're deploying your code. You're deploying your code into a configured environment and you're taking into account any changes to the configuration of that environment. So those three things, every time you do a deployment, you should be validating those three things. Now, you have done continuous integration in the past, and you've deployed maybe to an environment that you think is good, and so you're continually deploying to that environment, and then you deploy to production, and maybe something breaks. You might not have been validating the application infrastructure itself, just the code, but not the infrastructure or the configuration. And you really need to be doing all three of those things to be successful. Now, a continuous delivery pipeline can look different from from everybody, but there's some common core fundamentals. And somebody asked earlier, what are the steps to ALM? Hard to define that in the Q&A, because it's different for each company. Mm-hmm. There's some broad themes. Same with continuous delivery, there's some broad themes. And if you take a look at the slide, you can see that pipeline that we're trying to hit at a reliable cadence. Mm-hmm. You check in code and you get a build and unit tests. If they fail, you're done. You're done with your pipeline. Mm-hmm.
You got that feedback. Yeah. You can move on. You can keep going until it's done, and then you can go on to the next stage.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Absolutely. And then you might deploy to dev. You deploy to this environment where you say, we've made it, we've deployed it. If it fails during deployment, you're done. If it succeeds, run some of those functional tests. You saw we deployed to three environments, each with a different configuration, and then we ran functional tests against each of those. If they pass, then we can go on to the next step, which is deploy to a QA branch or a UAT or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, so yeah, and then once you're in QA, then what's the next step?
Feedback from customer or from your testers, right? We have to go in and validate some things, right? We can't automate everything, mm-hmm. so we have QAs and end testers and user acceptance testing that has to occur, right? It may not be all 100% automated, but we can get it as automated as possible.
Yeah, mm-hmm. absolutely. Then deploying off the UAT and deploying into production. Mm-hmm. And some places might have less or more formality. Our product has alpha customers, right? Yeah. So we deploy right into dev, and our UAT environment really is UAT. It's our production alpha. We call it prod alpha, and we deploy right to there so our customers can get a feel for it right away. Now, we've verified and we've automated a bunch of tests to make sure it doesn't get out there.
Yeah.
You know, any the bad stuff doesn't make it there, but occasionally.
It happens.
Yep, it happens. Mm-hmm. So here's the question Mary Poppendick asks. She says, how long would it take your organization to deploy a change that involved just a single line of code? And do you do this on a repeatable, reliable basis? Mm-hmm. And
I love that.
That's a great question.
Yeah.
Because a lot of places say, oh yeah, we can get that out in usually about 2 hours. How do I know? We had a production bug that brought down the entire site and we got it out in 2 hours. Mm-hmm. Okay, there you have a bound. You know you can do it. So why, pray tell, does your feature request that's not an emergency bug take 6 weeks to get into production? That's the next question you have to ask. Find out what is slowing down that pipeline and get into that pattern of continuous delivery. That continuous delivery is there's some principles of continuous delivery. I like these seven. Everyone's got their own set, but these seven I think are reasonable. You want to be able to create a repeatable, reliable process, just something that happens again and again and again. release day should be just another day. Yeah. It should be boring, right? Mm-hmm.
It should be the easiest day.
Yeah, exactly. Hey, we're going to production, so we got to sit around and just make sure everything's okay,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, exactly.
Bring out the swords, right? We're going to production. You should automate everything. I think automation is a key thing. And yeah. James does a ton of automation. I probably should pass this off to you. What should you and should you not automate?
Yeah, so this is a hard question, right? And it's never really something that you can really nail down to specific guidelines, right? They're very loose, informal things that you should do, right? Builds are a key thing to automate. Unit tests. I think deployments, packaging, versioning, and deploying those packages to the environments are necessary. Things that you absolutely necessary to have a continuous delivery pipeline, right? So we do a lot of that. You can go much farther beyond that, where you can do automated creation of your environments, where you set up a vanilla set of boxes and you install dependencies, install your system and have it up and running, install a bunch of test data. Right, that's a very advanced form of automation. Yep. But you can go there, right? You can do that. There's plenty of tools out there to do that sort of thing. But you keep going, keep pushing the bounds. Some things you don't want to automate, right? So there are things like look and feel, right? If I go look at something, right, I can't automate a test to say, hey, that looks great, that's easy to use, right? That's going to have to be a human interaction. And most likely, you know, some sort of feedback from whether or not it's a business analyst or an end user or user acceptance testing or something like that. Things like that. Another thing, if you're constantly changing how your UI functionality is just how it works, automating coded UI tests like that, it becomes very difficult and actually much harder and takes much more time to do versus just having someone run through the test themselves, right? Yep. There are some, like, you know, happy path sort of coded UI things, right? Like, I need to be able to log in constantly. That's probably something that you can automate via coded UI, right?
Sure.
But really, you want to be able to test small components, add more components to those components, and eventually get to your full end-to-end integration tests. So that by the time you get to some sort of environment where you have any end users, you've ran through all those regressions, you've done the manual validations that you need to do, so that when you get there, you're confident, and you're like, okay, now I just push the button and we're good to go, right?
Right. Yeah, and that automation just, when you push the button and it goes, the magic button, right? it's a wonderful warm feeling.
Yeah.
That happens. I want to make a distinction too between automation and scripting. A lot of times people say, oh, we've got full automation here. Someone just, all they do is they put a ticket in this system.
Yeah.
And I execute a PowerShell commandlet. That's not the same. If a technical person, someone not in the flow of value, mm-hmm. needs to go in and type some PowerShell and get a ticket, and now you're waiting for people. You've scripted it, which is great, it's faster feedback, but you should automate it. Let it just happen.
That's a great distinction. I go to a lot of companies where they say, oh, this particular process is fully automated. And then when we dig down to the details, it's like, oh, well, someone has to go copy all these files out here and then run these three scripts.
Yeah.
Right. And it's like, well, that's right. There's a discrepancy between what I think of automation, which is I don't even have to push a button. I just check my code in and it gets deployed, versus I have a set of scripts or a set of steps I have to walk through to have it automated. Right. And I think that's a big difference.
And
right?
I think it's a very real distinction. Mm-hmm. So watch out. If it makes sense to have that gate, if it's a user saying, yes, I want to see the next build. Having them click a button, that's fine. Mm-hmm. Or a testing group saying, we're done testing this environment, let's see the next environment. Letting them click a button, that's fine. Mm-hmm. But if they say, we want to see the next environment, they're the key stakeholder, and they have to submit a ticket for someone else to run scripting, probably not automated, just scripted.
Yeah.
Next core thing, and I love this one, pull the pain forward. If it hurts, do more of it. This goes against every grain as you know we have as humans, right? You run out and do a deployment, everything falls apart all around, and you spend the entire weekend, mm-hmm. sleeping at the office trying to get things pushed into production. You finally get it out there, and we made it. Oh man, production, that's terrible. Let's not go to production now. Let's just push that off. Let's do that every 6 months now, yeah. instead of every three. wrong path.
Yeah, and this one hits home to me a lot too, because I again have a lot of clients that I struggle where it, you know, it's not just the releases, but like I think a big thing is merging branches back into master, right? They're like, oh, merges are terrible. They're not fun to do. So we, you know, we wait 3 months and then we spend a week doing it. Right, you know, and then after that we have to retest everything because it's not the same code. These sorts of things, right? You have one line, one branch where you may have topic branches that you go off for a couple of hours, but you're constantly pushing and merging back into that master, getting that validation that things are working, right? I see companies constantly saying, oh, that release process was terrible. We had lots of errors. People had to stay up for 48 hours straight to get things working. Let's not do that for a long time, like Steve said, when in reality, you should do that more often so that process becomes easier and more streamlined.
Yep. And it forces a lot of good functions. Mm-hmm. Or it's a forcing function for a lot of good behaviors.
Yeah.
If it hurts and the merge hurts, you might end up in a single code line or with very limited feature branches going off of those or topic branches. It kind of drives good behaviors. Mm-hmm. Next thing, build quality in. Don't think that you can get away with throwing quality over the wall and waiting for someone else to feed you back.
Yeah.
Done means released. I cannot stand it when I go to talk to dev teams and they say, well, we can't take responsibility for release. That's operations. We need to say we're done when we're at the end of the sprint. Well, okay. And maybe there's a doneness that's there, but you're not engaging operations then to say, let's get it to production. And if you start to give credit to people for work that is sitting somewhere but not actually delivered, that's not good. You really want to have those things into production as quickly as possible. Or, at a minimum, if your customers can't take production updates quickly, at least get it into a production-like environment that real users can get into and give you feedback. Everyone's responsible. There is no, it's dev's fault, it's ops' fault. The product fails, everybody's in there getting it to work, they get it out the door. And you're focused on this continuous cadence of improvement. Don't let it fall behind. You're going to want to continuously improve. And how you do that is by pulling more pain forward and to get that continuous improvement. There's a lot of benefits of continuous delivery. I'm gonna name a few. First is empowered teams. I think it's magic pixie dust, if you would. It feels like you're reaching out to your teams and just sprinkling on this pixie dust that causes them to work together better. It's silly, mm-hmm. but it just seems to work. Reducing errors is a big one. If you have manual deployments, you are taking very intelligent, very creative people and having them read through a checklist doing rote, repetitive, boring things. That is a combination with failure written all over it. You just don't want to have really creative, driven people doing really rote, boring things. Things get dropped.
And or it's anything.
Not, or anything, right?
Or anybody. Right?
Anybody doing
yeah, absolutely.
That. Exactly.
It's just, human error just happens.
It does. I like lowering stress as a benefit.
Yeah.
honestly, you would think that pulling the pain forward would cause more stress, but in reality, it's actually less. You are going to production often enough that you don't really notice that pain. I'm gonna go with this story. Etsy, Mike Britton was talking about Etsy, and he gave an excellent anecdote. He said, at Etsy, day one, when they hire a developer, they push code to production. They make a code change. It's adding their photo to the library, but they push a code change all the way through to production on day one. Day two, they fill out their HR forms. First things first, get something into production. And that focus on production, I think, is huge. And that lowers stress. I've been to production before, and we went yesterday, twice. So I'm not stressed out about it, right? Deployment flexibility. If you have a big pile of changes, you often can't be very flexible on how you deploy or where you deploy. If it's a small change, you can often just go to different areas to deploy. Plus, practice makes perfect. Do it often, bang, 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 bang. As you do that again and again and again and again, you just get used to it and it flows right through. And my two favorite are reduced risk And I'll start with that one. This is where large batches of code going infrequently into production result in a lot of changes and very high risk. Whereas if you have small batches of code that go very often, you have little change with a lot lower risk. And I think this is one of those very interesting things. You can go look at it online. John Allspaw has a good thing called Ops Metametrics. It's a presentation that you can see on SlideShare. And he walks through the angry deployment monster and the happy deployment monster, which actually, the graphic's kind of a fun one to see. But that's that reduced risk. Don't deploy big changes, because that ends up with very high risk. Instead, deploy small changes very, very frequently. You only have a little bit of risk. Plus, if you deploy a giant change, like 2,000 lines of code, and that's, for a lot of our customers, that's not a giant change.
No.
But if you're deploying a change that big, where is the error when it fails? It's a lot harder to pinpoint the error. Whereas if you're deploying a change that's 50 lines of code, you can identify that error and troubleshoot it very quickly and get that fix back out into production. And then this is going to come back to James's comment earlier, which was fast feedback as the next benefit. Get through this circle of love, this ALM circle of love quickly. Plan, dev, test, release, monitor to learn, get the feedback.
Yeah, this is just something that I love to hammer into teams and just people in general when I'm talking about ALM, DevOps, lean principles or agile principles, right? Fast feedback is kind of the name of the game. Whether it's human feedback, unit testing feedback, anything, right? Any sort of feedback is great. The more of it, the better, right?
Absolutely.
And it's easier to make decisions when you have feedback versus, what do you think the users think of this feature?
Right, exactly. Because you just aren't going to know what the users think of your feature until it gets into their hands. They may claim up and down, oh, we would so buy that feature. You ship it, and they're like, well, we would buy it if we had infinite money. But we don't have that, so we actually aren't going to care about the feature. You need that feedback. It's critical. Let's talk about some patterns and anti-patterns for continuous delivery. Here's some anti-patterns. You're deploying software manually. If you need lots of document, if you have a Word doc that walks you through or a wiki somewhere that walks you through deployment, probably have a problem.
Mm-hmm.
If you have corrections during a release, manual testing to confirm your deployments, if releases take hours instead of minutes, unless you've got a crazy complex automated deployment, it should be fast.
Mm-hmm.
Late nights, stress, headaches, trips to the doctor, whatever. Those are good indicators. Instead, automate those deployments. Make sure that you just get them all scripted and out. The nice thing about the automation scripts is they are the configuration of the deployment as code. And they are the truth. They're your golden repo for what is the truth of our deployment, what actually was requested to happen. And then your logs are what actually happened based on those. And you have, what did we ask to deploy? What actually happened? We now have the truth. It's not going back to James and saying, so how did you deploy it? Well, I was going through all these steps. Did you do all of them? I'm pretty sure.
Yeah.
But I'm not positive. Yeah, I did them all. Well, then how come the web.config didn't get updated and it was pointing at the wrong? That kind of stuff just goes away. Automate those, make them repeatable, make them fast. Another very big anti-pattern is a single prod-like environment. If the testers test an environment that doesn't look like code, that you're deploying things on top of each other, different versions, it's my turn for my version, it gets deployed into the test environment, it's one box instead of 12, you're not testing your failover, you're not testing your scalability, oh my goodness, you've got problems. A lot of fighting between ops and dev, a lot of fighting between testers and dev.
Yep.
You experienced this just recently.
Yeah, just a couple weeks ago. Just not a lot of fighting, but just basically a lot of ceremony around what version of this application is going to be on this machine, right? Or I'll be testing on this and all of a sudden a new version comes in and I'm not done testing yet. Just because of, it's hard to communicate that sort of thing, right? If it's all manual processes. Whereas if it's automated, you can say, hey, I want this version here, click. And it'll get deployed.
And I really like this, and James didn't mention it, but I think it's worth talking about Azure. The cloud mm-hmm. can enable those sorts of things. When you're on premises, they had three deployment environments, or three test environments, was that right, or two?
I'm not exactly.
It was a limited number of test environments, and what happened was people they would step over each other, just mm-hmm. like James mentioned. Took that, moved it to a continuous delivery pipeline that pointed to an Azure dev test environment, and what testers are now able to do is say, I want this environment with this configuration, with this version of the application, go, and it spins them up a clean environment from scratch out in Azure, and they can go test on their own with no fear that anybody's going to step on top of their test environment. Mm-hmm. And they can just tear it down when they're done. Very clean, very easy, and it allows them to get that faster feedback without stepping on each other's toes that was happening. I was just so absolutely impressed.
It was really fun.
It was. Mm-hmm. And like they came back and said, it's a game changer, right? Mm-hmm. That type of thing that you get can be a game changer mm-hmm. for your development environment.
That's huge. Just one piece, right? Like there's so many other pieces that go along ALM and DevOps. Like that's just spinning up test environments and deploying code to it, right?
Right.
There's still a long road ahead of them, but it's just one piece. And it's crazy how one thing can have such a massive impact in some places.
It's pixie dust.
Yeah.
it's amazing stuff.
Yeah.
So instead of that single prod environment, have multiple environments. Get a production-like staging environment, maybe many production staging environments that mm-hmm. you can spin up at the click of a button.
Yep.
Integrate your testing, development, and release as part of that standard development process.
Mm-hmm.
Next, anti-pattern. Manual configuration. We deployed. Now, before we let anybody in, let's go open up the web config and point to the new database, the production database. If that happens, you are open for all sorts of pains. Just don't. Let's just say just don't. Get out of that habit. It's difficult. It takes an upfront investment. But it's not an investment of weeks and weeks and weeks of time. It's generally an investment of a week, or it's measured in days. It might be a couple weeks, but it's measured in days, not in large numbers of weeks. Mm-hmm. Other things, differences between similar nodes in production. This drives me crazy. We've got five web heads that are out scaling our website, but they're not quite configured the same.
Yeah.
And it's common.
Yeah,
you can't roll back your environment. You know, I'm sympathetic to this a little bit. I've been involved in big initiatives to roll back environments. I mean, we can roll back our environment. I think it's important, don't get me wrong. But when you actually ask people how many times they've rolled back, very often that answer is zero. And you can be going back years and years and years. Why? Because they tend to roll forward on deployments. If you're deploying something to a website, you run into those problems, and it maybe you just fix them and get the fix out there, and you roll forward instead. Those are some of the critical ones. Those are the anti-patterns. Instead, set up your entire environment using an automated process, key point, that is stored in version control. Must be in version control. If it's not in version control, it doesn't exist, because when I click a button and I deploy my new environment, it had better blow away any configurations anyone did manually, because mm-hmm. I want to fail fast.
Yep.
Go back to that fast failure. Mm-hmm. All your configuration, all your OS configuration, all of your tools, everything that you configure that you need for deployment, you need to get into version control. Your production environment is key in this. Got to be able to reproduce your production environment and make sure that any changes to the environment that you're pushing to test, pushing to UAT, get pushed out to production as well. UAT being the user acceptance testing. Mm-hmm. Might be a staging area that you might call it something else. Whew. How do we get started with DevOps? I think this is a great time to break from slides. We've done a lot of slides and get into configuring a continuous integration build. James, over to you.
Perfect. So what we're going to do is one of the things that we can automate is automated builds, right? So we're going to look at one of our continuous integration builds that you saw get triggered whenever we published that new branch called user user page, or I can't remember what something. It's called. So let's jump over to my box here.
And I want to interrupt because I think that is absolutely fantastic. We don't even remember the name of the branch. It bubbled up. We had a branch. We did a pull request, deleted the branch, and you didn't even remember it. And how
it's
cool is that?
Now.
It's gone.
I have no idea.
It's in production. And literally, it's in production. We pushed the magic button. Mm-hmm. I'll have to go and show you on the demo site. Probably worth showing the application in that so that people can see that it actually went there and what happens. But we'll show you on a production version of it.
Okay,
back to you.
Cool. So if we jump in here, we have one of our CI builds down here called web.ci. So if I just go ahead and edit this build definition, for those of you that aren't familiar with team build, this is kind of what a build definition looks like. You have a name, and then you have some other things down on the side. So one of them is triggers. Our trigger is continuous integration. What this means is that every time a commit is published to one of those branches, this build will get triggered and build the code. Now, there's something really cool that you can do with Git. That's not as easily done in Team Foundation version control. And that is, I can point at a Git repository, web.aurelia, and what I can do down here is I can say, I want to include every single branch. So we just put refs heads slash star. That's going to pick up every single branch. That means any change to any branch, any new branches that are published, anything is going to get picked up by this build, which is really cool, which means that if we create a new branch, we don't have to create a new build definition and point to that branch, right? It just gets built and our CI gets triggered and the unit tests get run and passed or fail, right? We get that fast feedback every single time we create a branch and push it, right? We don't have to do any extra steps or any extra manual setup in order to get that fast feedback set up. Now, there's an important part here. You notice that we have CI builds that are looking at every single branch, but what about master, right? You don't want the CI build to get triggered for master. You want the other build that actually deploys the code to development to a dev environment on the master branch. So back on my machine, we include every single branch, but we exclude the master branch. What that means is that this will get triggered for every branch except for master. I find this to be a really cool thing that you can do with Git. And I just kind of wanted to share that because it's a really easy way to set up a CI build, right?
And that comes back to a question that somebody posted online, which was, I have my branches that I've taken. You notice James did the association of the work item on the branch and then merged the branch to master. In TFS 2012, that the thing was that loses that association, right?
Yeah.
You lose
that
association. And the question was, is that fixed in 2013? The answer is yes, but it doesn't, you can't do that with Team Foundation version control because that doesn't maintain it. It's a new, when you take a branch and you merge it in, it's a brand new commit or a brand new change set that's created. If you happen to be using Git, however, all of those are preserved. We don't lose any of those with Git. So even though we've deleted the branch completely, that history is still in the master branch of the Git repository. Mm-hmm. It's just the way distributed version control systems work. It's very easy. They just don't lose that kind of association, where it's much harder in something like TF version control. But there are plugins.
And it's not like it's not that the association is lost in Team Foundation version control. It's just not carried over to the branch once you merge it back in.
Right. That's right. You have to go back and trace back to an earlier branch. You need to trace the changes back to find out that commit. Mm-hmm. That's not a bad thing. TF version control has wonderful capabilities. But that particular one was brought up in the Q&A. And I wanted to address it because you mm-hmm. were just talking about the branches and the merges.
Yeah.
Thanks, James, for letting me interrupt.
Cool. So the next thing is build defaults. This is basically just where you drop your code. And there's a bunch of options. Mainly, don't copy it anywhere. Copy it to a network share or copy it back into TFS, which is great. It'll actually just copy the binaries and store them in TFS, just in the same database all your other information is located at. So you don't even have to worry about it. So we typically just copy it to we copy the build output to the server, so we just don't have to worry about it. It cleans itself up so that you don't have massive database growth over the long term, right? Now the next part is kind of the interesting part, and this is where we do a lot of our extra stuff around builds themselves. So if we jump back in here, we'll notice there's a couple things here. We have Git. We don't clean the repository. It's a CI build. We want these to run fast, right? The idea that I've heard from other people is you want it to be faster than it takes for a developer to get to his car. Or out the door. Out the door.
Or to the elevator.
To the elevator, right? So that if it does fail, you have that fast feedback and say, hey, you just left with a broken build. Don't do that because we can't work in the morning. Right? If you don't have a clean working build, you know, you can't add new code to it. You have to fix it first.
Right. And we have a globally distributed team at Northwest Cadence. Mm-hmm. We have one member of our team is living in South Africa, Colin Dembowski. And Colin, mm-hmm. if he went to bed, committed a bunch of code that broke the build, we'd be struggling then when we came in.
Yeah, so we have to fix the build first.
Very much, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Cool. The next thing is we just have one solution. We just build that solution, but the advanced part of this build is we have a pre-build script. What this pre-build script does is it actually runs through all of our assemblies and versions the assemblies to match the build definition. So it pulls the build definition version itself and actually stamps all the assemblies with that prior to it being built. This way, we can actually go in any code that's been deployed, we can just look at the version of the assembly and say, is this right? Is this matching all the other versions of the assemblies? Is this what we expected? Is there like a version 1.0.0 that someone just deployed from their desktop, right? It's very easy for us to just trace that back from the actual assembly, the actual code, back to the build, back to the change step, back to the work items, right? It's all one really easy way to trace things all the way through. So that's one piece, right? Versioning and packaging is a huge thing. So the second thing we do is we use a NuGet package. And if you're not familiar with NuGet packages, they're typically for external dependencies, like external assembly references, that sort of thing. But they also do a lot of other cool things too, right? So we use one called Octopack that just adds an MS build target and runs, it packages your code up as long as you have a new spec file there, and you can do things such as push that NuGet package up, right? So if we look at our MS build arguments, we don't do that on the CI build. I'm sorry, I got ahead of myself. That's for the actual deployment.
Right.
Yes, sorry. So during the deployment, that's on our deployment build. That does the actual packaging and version, the packaging and pushing. We don't do that on our CI build.
Now you're going to have to pull it up though and show
yes,
it a little
I know.
Bit.
I know.
Because now you've hinted at it. Now you're going to have to show that workflow.
That's totally okay though. So I bring up the web build, which is almost identical to the CI build. It just has, you know, things like packaging and pushing. So let's open that up. Go to the process. And we'll see here in the build, the advanced, we have some other things here that are basically, run Octopack, which will, you know, run the packaging and the pushing. And then we also want to push it to our NuGet feed, right? Which is hosted in an Azure website. Or actually, it's an Azure virtual machine, I apologize. So that's, you know, that's another thing that we run. It's just MS build arguments, and it makes it really easy. It runs during build, so you don't have to have any extra scripts or anything like that. Now, the final bit here is the fact that we have, the post test script, right? So we have a post test script that will actually create a release based off of the package that we pushed using Octopack. And it will actually create a release and deploy that into the dev environment, right? The really cool thing with TFS build is these little post test, pre-test, and post-build and pre-build scripts and arguments come out of box with team build, right? You just open up a team build, brand new build definition, and you just have those. And they just point to files and version control, right? You want to version these scripts that do, you know, the versioning and the releasing and that sort of thing so that you can change them and iterate them and refine them over time versus just having some script out there on a machine that you have to run, right? It's part of the code. It's kind of that DevOps and coming together where you have operational functions in the actual code itself, right? So this is just a quick, easy way, right? Create an automated build, version your code, package it and push it, right? Really simple things. A lot of our PowerShell scripts are no longer than 20 lines, right? Really simple things. Cool. So that's kind of it for the builds. A quick, easy way to just kind of jump into DevOps, especially if you have just, you know, that in and of itself could be a big struggle for companies that have very large applications, right? But that's a step towards that DevOps world.
Absolutely. There was a question someone asked, and they said, are you going to show the entire end-to-end pipeline? And we would love to. It is one of the presentations we do, but it is it takes a while to walk through it. Like we mentioned, it's relatively complicated. There's a lot of compilation builds, deploys, all the dependencies are managed in NuGet. Then there's the deployment pieces, the actual spinning up of brand new environments. There's a lot that goes into it. So we won't be walking through all of it just because of the time constraints, but it's interesting.
Yeah.
And maybe we can, I know we have a blog series coming up, and we'll put that in the notes. And that kind of walks through the tools we use, how we're doing it, what we're doing. And I think
it's very in-depth.
And it's, exactly. Mm-hmm. It's very in-depth technically. So that would give you maybe a better understanding. But that's a great question.
Yep.
I think that what you hit, that initial part, though, is very important. That basic understanding of what does it take to just get the build piece working.
Yep.
Now you've got the deployment, the testing, the validation as we go. Let's flip back over and kind of wrap this DevOps section. And I want to wrap it with some slides that talk about the three things that we need to talk about when we initially have that DevOps conversation. And that's people, process, and tools, right? I want to beat it into everyone's head. It's a crazy thing. It's the same thing we talked about in ALM, same thing we talked about in DevOps, the same thing we talk about when you consider bringing any process or tooling into your organization. Think about the people. It's a people, process, tools. And we won't need to go into depth on each of these, but you need to care and be concerned about each of them. A couple characteristics. It's a full lifecycle investment. Don't look at it just as we're going to automate our builds and be done. It's a team effort, especially between the development and the IT operations teams. And it enables some really good development and delivery practices. And I think this last one, that last mile of delivery, if we can accelerate that, get faster at getting it into production with smaller pieces, there's not so much change, we really can make life easier for both the developers and operations. And this is that key thing. Remember, we have the butting of heads between the developers and between the developers and operations, because operations is paid to keep things stable. Development is paid to change things. If we can get to a place where we're releasing very quickly but very small changes, our risk goes down. Our stability, we don't lose our stability because our changes are small and predictable, and both teams can work together to achieve that. So those are the pieces. There's some metrics you should capture. Don't try to capture a million different metrics. Mm-hmm. When you're starting off your DevOps initiative, I like this one. Deployment frequency. How many times do we deploy to production? Is it once a day, twice a day, 15 times a day, once a week, twice a week, 15 times a year, whatever that measure is, start looking at that deployment frequency. And the pushback you want on deployment frequency should not come from operations. The only legitimate pushback should come from your customers. Your customers, if you're delivering shipped products, may say, we can't take them more than once every 3 months. But beware, there might be ways to even get around that. Think of the Windows updates that come to your desktop every Tuesday or Wednesday or whenever they come, they just appear, and there are small changes, fixes, and improvements that appear without you needing to make an explicit decision and learn some new functionality. It just happens behind the scenes. Next metric is change lead time. You come up with an idea, you commit to delivering it, how long does it take to get it into production? Mm-hmm. And the very last slide of this entire MVA, I'm going to talk about why you do not have to spend as much time estimating as you think you do. We'll talk about how to reduce estimation time to seconds rather than minutes or hours as we start talking about things. Next, on the reliability side, you've got two additional metrics. Change fail rate. How often when we push something out to production does it fail? That's important. Or not just production, test as well. And the mean time to detect and repair any of those failures. Those are two good reliability performance indicators. So watch those. Don't try to overwhelm people with metrics. If you show someone 50 metrics, we want to maximize these, let's say 15 metrics, a much smaller number.
Or 10.
Or 10, right? We want to maximize these 10 metrics.
Yeah.
And James walks into work, he looks up at the metrics board and says, yeah, 10 metrics. How do I change my behavior to account for those 10 metrics? I want to optimize those 10 metrics. It's very difficult for James to do. 2 metrics, 3 metrics, he can do very, very easily. That's the cycle time. Those are some of the metrics you want. How you implement, and I want to bring 3 different ways here, how you implement. The first way is through something called systems thinking. You look at the end-to-end system, and you're not optimizing dev, you're not optimizing ops, you're looking across the board at the entire system from an analytical standpoint. I think that is one of the first things. There's books on system thinking. It really needs to take hold in your organization. But it is an analytical view. And there's a second view that also can add on to that, and that's providing feedback to close that loop. So you may have a systems view, but now you're providing feedback between development and operations, and that gives us our second view. And that feedback then becomes important. Next, we'll take a look at our third view, and we're going to connect that loop and add experimentation. And these are small little experiments that we can potentially run inside of a delivery to learn something. And I'm going to give one quick example. We worked with a customer that delivers stuff out to, it's an online web presence. You order stuff from the store. They have nationwide distributors, and then they ship from the local areas nearby you. So what does that mean for them? Well, they had an idea. Why don't we ship, have people enter their zip code, and bubble up on their search things that are closest to them so that we can reduce the overall shipping costs? Because if we reduce the shipping costs, they're probably more likely to buy. So they were rolling forward with that, did some estimation, and they decided that'll take about 2 sprints to deliver, because you have to change their entire back-end pipeline things for searching. Now, 2 sprints with a full team is a lot of expenditure. So we asked the simple question, which is how many people are even willing to enter their zip code when they first hit your site? And we didn't know the answer to that. So instead of going through that whole process, we did the first step, which is let's pop up a form and have somebody enter in their zip code before the shopping experience. That took 1 person less than 4 hours to get into the entire thing. It's all built, tracked, and we can decide how many people do it. They ran an experiment, and they decided if more than 25% of the people enter their zip code, it's going to be worth implementing in following sprints. They ran an experiment because they didn't know for sure. Remember, not everything has value. So what they did, threw that in there. Sure enough, far more than 25% of the people entered their zip codes, pulled the trigger to make that happen as part of that 2-sprint commit. But they learned from an experimentation, and they were able to do that because they were able to take this experiment and simply throw it to production very easily in the middle of a sprint, get enough data that they could justify saying, hey, let's prioritize this and build it. So that's that experimentation piece. The important thing that I want you to remember as we close out this section is DevOps is, in James' words, all about delivering value. You want to make sure that we take that cycle time, shrink it down, get fast feedback with delivered value quickly, learn from it, and continuously improve. Go ahead and enter some questions back into the console, and we're going to take a 10-minute break. We'll be back in 10 minutes. We'll answer some questions, and if the questions are appropriate, we'll go ahead and talk about those in the next section as well. So we'll see you in 10 minutes, where we'll be talking now about quality, not just from a tester perspective, but quality end-to-end. Mm-hmm. We'll see you in 10.
Bye.